The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday Space Show program. And I am the host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in tonight. And we actually did start on time. This will be a very short introduction. I made the mistake of not turning on the streaming button. And thanks for John in Reading for calling to tell me that he wasn't getting the stream. So I'll do a very, very quick start in introduction. Our toll-free number, if you would like to call us, is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we're listener-supported, and we do look for your financial support to keep us on the air. We have a PayPal button at the top of every one of our pages for you to contribute. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, and that means that if you do donate to us, you get a tax deduction for the year your donation was made. The same is true for California, so that's federal and California. And we also have sponsors, and if you sponsor us, you get the banner ad going across our homepage. And we'll probably won't do a full 90 minutes of broadcasting because of the screw-up I made. But I'm going to shout out to our sponsors. They're great. We wouldn't be doing the show without them. Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, Moonwards, Celestis, and the Space Plan. And again, without their great support, we wouldn't be doing this show. Most of the other announcements, you know, because they're pretty routine from time to time. We do have a great guest with us. He was on Hotel Mars a couple of weeks ago talking about exoplanets. And we're going to continue that discussion with the Space Show format. And I'm very happy that Dr. Jeff Coughlin is with us. He's an astrophysicist with SETI and has worked with the Kepler K2 mission for the past 7 years. He's had a PhD in astronomy from New Mexico State. He mainly focused on measuring fundamental parameters in exoplanets and stars using data from then newly launched Kepler telescope. While with SETI and the Kepler K2 mission, he has been a leading member of the team that discovers and classifies new exoplanets. In particular, he has focused on developing methods of automating discovery via computer algorithms, which have enabled the determination of how common planets, especially those like Earth, are in the cosmos. And listeners, I started the program before I realized that I forgot to turn on streaming by asking our guest, Dr. Coughlin, just why is he calling Earth a common planet? And for the most part, he said it's because they've detected many such planets the size of Earth that have water that are somewhat near to their sun, and that's pretty common. Jeff, welcome to the Space Show for the second time tonight. And thank you for your patience. Did I do a good summary of why you're saying Earth is common?
Yeah, pretty good. I'll correct that. We don't know for sure whether some of the planets we found have water or not, but we know that statistically there's a large number that should be at the right distance where they could have liquid water. So we know it wouldn't be boiling or frozen, but the conditions are right.
What do we have to do to know that they have liquid water on them?
We would need the basically kind of next generation of telescopes, things like James Webb and the telescopes afterwards to follow up and look at each one in detail. And then we could actually know for each individual planet whether there's water or not.
So what would be the signs that there was liquid water?
So one way that we can do it is we are able to probe the atmosphere of some of these worlds, and by looking at the light from the host star as it goes through each planet's atmosphere, we can kind of tell the chemical signature of different elements. So water imparts a unique signal to the light. And so if we take a look, we can look at the light spectrum and say, oh, there's water in that planet's atmosphere, and I can kind of estimate how much.
So does liquid water have a different signature than ice?
Yeah, so if a world was really completely frozen by ice, that'd be tough to tell that there was frozen ice water on there. But for a planet like Earth that has lots of water vapor in the atmosphere, that's something that hopefully in the near future we'll be able to see.
So as I told you while we were having such a good time talking before the show started, which is why I forgot to turn the streaming on, I have a listener in Montana who can't listen live, and he sent in two early questions. And so the first one is he wants you to summarize the methods of detecting exoplanets. Has the methodology changed in recent years, and is there a preferred method of detecting them?
Yeah, fantastic question. And there's actually about five main methods, and so I'll go through each one real quickly, and I'll kind of try and do it in chronological order
okay,
as we used them as we developed better technology over the decades. So the first one, which actually didn't pan out, but it was the first method people thought of, is called astrometry. So in this method, you look at the star and you take an image of the star, which going back to the late 1800s has been easy. With telescopes and photographic plates, we've been able to measure the position of stars pretty well. And what you do is you measure that position of the star night after night, day after day, and what you're looking for is for that star to be making tiny little circles in the sky. And so if that star is moving around with a regular period, what you can infer is that there's something that you can't see that's tugging at it. And so the idea back in the day was, all right, we look at these stars, look at a bunch of them. If you see any that are making regular circles in the sky, there must be a planet tugging at it. And so there were actually a number of claims of planet detections going back to the late 1800s, throughout the 1900s, of finding planets by this method. And unfortunately, none of them really panned out. With modern instruments, we now have some solid detections. But those early ones were tricky. There were a lot of errors in the telescope, subtleties in the way Earth's movement is corrected for. But that was one of the first early methods that people started using.
And then what are the later methods? What keep going?
Yeah, and then the big one that really paid off was called radial velocity. And so it's a similar philosophy. But what we do is we look at a star, and when you look at the spectrum of light from a star and measure it in multiple wavelengths, what you can do is actually measure the position of that star really precisely. So starting in the late 80s and early 90s, we were able to measure stars to about below a kilometer a second speed, which sounds fast, but that's pretty darn slow for space speed. And so similar thing, you measure the speed of that star, and if you see it moving towards you and then away from you and towards you and from away from you with a period of, say, 30 days, you can infer, oh, there's probably a planet tugging at that star with a period of 30 days. And so that's the method that starting in the early 90s really hit pay dirt throughout most of the 90s and into the 2000s, and we started finding one and two, and then by the dozens and by the hundreds each year.
And that's still being used, that method?
And still being used to this day, yeah, and it's a great way to confirm planets found by other methods as well. And they're getting more and more sensitive, and the goal kind of in the next decade is to try and get the centimeter per second velocity. So you're measuring these stars light years away to centimeter per second. And that's kind of what you need to be able to detect a planet like Earth going around a star like the Sun. So we're not quite there yet. We've gotten to about meter per second. But the goal is to get to centimeter per second.
What are some of the other ways?
My personal favorite is called the transit method, because that's the method that Kepler uses. And so similar to the other two, you stare at a star and you look at a bunch of them at once, and sometimes some of the planets around those stars will be lined up just right that they'll pass in front of the star as we see it from Earth. And when that happens, it blocks out a little bit of light. So you stare at these stars and you measure the brightness continuously, and you see a little dip. And some period of time goes by, and you see another dip. And that same period of time goes by, you see another dip. And so you see this regular dipping, and that's, you can infer it's due to a planet passing in front. And because Kepler was able to measure hundreds of thousands of stars all at the same time, that's how we were able to detect thousands of exoplanets all at once.
When you detect all at once, can you distinguish between planets, or do you just see a mass of exoplanets?
Luckily, we can distinguish, so we're able to isolate each individual star. So when we see a dip, we go, oh, I saw that dip. That's a period of 30 days. That's coming from that star right there. And because I kind of got a good estimate of how big that star is and how big that dip is, I know how big that planet is. Because the bigger the planet, the more light it'll block out. The smaller the planet, the less light you see decrease.
So that's number three. What's number four?
And the number four is a really neat one that you'll get this thanks to Einstein. We can actually use this technique. So it's called microlensing. And what Einstein realized with general relativity is that massive objects like stars bend light as light beams pass close to them. And so if you imagine that every beam of light that passes near a star gets bent, basically every star in the universe is a giant lens, is a giant telescope that focuses light. But that focal length is over tens of thousands of light years. It's really long. So what we can do is we stare towards the center of the galaxy, and you monitor the brightness of a bunch of stars at once. And what happens is the stars are slowly drifting throughout the galaxy, and we're all going rotating around the core. What'll happen is, once in a while, by chance, you'll have a star line up perfectly between us and a background star. And when it lines up just right for a couple days, it'll act as a giant lens, and it'll magnify the brightness of the star in the background. So you'll see this star, it's really faint, really faint, and then it'll all of a sudden get 10,000 times brighter, which sticks out like a sore thumb. The great thing about it is it also magnifies any light from the planet as well. The planet of the, if there's a planet around the middle star between us and the far one, that planet will lend some of that light. So you'll see one big spike, and then you'll see a tiny little spike next to it. And so by looking for tiny little spikes, you can say, oh, there was a planet around that star halfway across the galaxy. And so that's that one always blows my mind when I think about it, of everything that has to line up just perfectly across tens of thousands of light years.
But you can't control that. It's just whatever you're able to detect happening, right?
That's right. And you see it once, and you're done. And you're never going to see that planetary system line up that way again. But when you look at tens of thousands of stars at once, and you see a couple of them, you're able to statistically say, oh, yeah, I got a good handle on how many planets are likely out there.
Well, if you see it and you know that it's there, can you then go find it, say, with the transit method?
If it happened to line up just right, potentially, in those cases with microlensing, it's not really sensitive to the close-in, short-period planets that are easy to see with transits. In those cases, you see planets more like Jupiter that are far away from their host stars. So it's kind of a complementary method.
And the fifth and final?
And the fifth and final is, I think, kind of the most exciting one for the next couple decades, and that's direct imaging. So what you do is you take an image of a star, but you get really, really high-resolution image, and you have some fancy optics and other methods to block out the light from that star. And in that case, what you can do is actually directly get an image of a planet. And so I think we've gotten at least a dozen different planets by this method. Right now, they're really kind of hot Jupiter-sized planets, but the goal is to be able to do this for Earth-like planets around nearby stars. And so ultimately, what you would have is the image of the star and about a billion times fainter an image of a tiny little Earth next to it. And in that case, you're actually directly getting light directly from that planet. And, of course, with that direct light from that planet, you can much easier tell the composition and maybe what's in its atmosphere.
So with all these planets you're finding, where are all our cousins and neighbors?
That's right. So statistically, they're all around us. We're finding that small, rocky planets the size of Earth seem to be incredibly common, and that probably every single planet has at least one star, and most definitely there's more planets than stars in our galaxy.
Boy, that's quite the opposite of what we... I'm an old-timer, so what I learned in school, you know, that the planets were rare and stars were everywhere.
Yeah, it still blows my mind, even being in the field. But, yeah, you go out at night and you look at the sky and you see a couple thousand stars, you know there's probably several thousand, if not more, planets that you're actually looking at the same time. And that just means that with hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy, there's probably trillions of planets.
Wow. My Montana friend had another question, and you've kind of talked about this a little bit, but this will get you to elaborate. When we're moving toward the capability of detecting what's in the atmosphere of an exoplanet, like you mentioned water before, or I guess we could say biosignatures or life signatures, are you able to do this and itemize it to a particular planet, or are you able to do it only sort of in a broad general way, but you can't separate it out and isolate it to a specific planet and a specific atmosphere?
Yeah, great, great question. So I think the short answer, and I'll do the long one, the short answer is we can isolate each individual planet. And the long answer is it depends a little bit on which method you're using. So if you're using the transit method, every planet in a particular system will have a different period. And so you'll have to know that the planets exist ahead of time before you go and look for any atmospheric features. But because you know they exist and you know their period, you know exactly when they're going to pass between us and their host star. So you know, okay, I'm looking at this instant, planet B is passing in front, but I know planet C isn't. So if I see any atmospheric signature, that must be due to planet B. So that's one way. And the other way is with the direct imaging. Similarly, if you take a direct image, you can actually isolate multiple planets at once. So there are some great pictures out there already of multi-planet systems that have been directly imaged. And you see the central star with its light greatly suppressed due to those great optics, and you'll see actually 2, 3, 4 points of light, one for each planet. And in that case, because you've actually separated out the light from each planet, you can know, oh, this signature belongs to this planet, this signature belongs to this planet. So, yeah, fantastic question, but it's neat we can actually... For some of these systems that have, we know of some systems that have 7, 8, 9 planets in them, that you can actually compare one day the atmospheres of all those different planets and see if they're all similar or kind of like our solar system, if they're all different.
Now, I know you mentioned that you have just recently returned from a conference in Hawaii. What's new, exciting, thrilling? What's being discovered? What's cutting-edge news for us?
Yeah, that was a fun one. Every year there's an annual American Astronomical Society conference, and this year it was in Hawaii, which is, you know, just a pain to go to, let me tell you.
Yeah, right. I can imagine.
Right?
Especially since you're what, in Los Angeles?
Yeah, West Coast. So I escaped a lot of the rain recently and got out there. But yeah, there's so many discoveries being made. And so I wrote down a few of them. I think one of the coolest ones, to me personally, was the TESS satellite, which stands for Transiting Exoplanet Space Satellite.
Uh-huh.
That's been operating for about 2 years now. They just announced their first basically Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone that they found. So this thing is called TOI 700, and it's about 20% larger than Earth, which pretty much squarely puts it as very, very likely to be rocky, not a gas giant like Neptune or Uranus, but a nice rocky world like us with hopefully a solid surface and an atmosphere that's not overly oppressive. And it seems to be in a similar spot in its habitable zone as Earth is in the solar system. So that was neat to see yet another possibly habitable planet out there. It's a little different from us in that its host star is an M-dwarf, so it's a small red star versus our large yellow star. And that has some interesting implications for potential habitability. But at the end of the day, it was just neat to see, oh, look, yet another Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone. It's almost getting boring at this point.
How far away is that from Earth?
This one was close to. I believe this one was about 40 light years. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure it was right around there.
Yeah, close, just around the corner, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a stone's throw in astronomy distances.
Are we close to knowing what's in the atmosphere of that, or that's far off in the future still?
You know, it's in the future, but I don't think it's that far in the future. Another neat thing I saw come out of the conference was kind of examining the capabilities of the James Webb Space Telescope, which is, I think, scheduled to launch in late next year. And that thing will be 6.5 times the size of Hubble, it's tuned to be able to do some of these atmospheric observations that, we're hoping to do. And the kind of question right now is how small a planet we'll be able to snip out. The bigger the planet, the easier it is to tell what its atmosphere is made of. For small Earth-like planets, the real challenge. But there was kind of a nice news release that said, yeah, James Webb, for some of these Earth-type planets around these small M-dwarf stars, like this new one, TOI 700, that there's a good chance that it'll be able to detect a signature of water, at least. So that's really exciting, that maybe as soon as a couple years, we could have an announcement of water on a potentially habitable planet. Maybe it'll take 5 or 10 or longer, but I would actually bet on the shorter side than the longer side.
Karen is in Seattle with an email question for you, and she said, just how many biosignatures would need to be detected in an exoplanet atmosphere for scientists to be really excited about the possibility of life on that exoplanet?
Fantastic question. I would say just one would get a lot of people excited. if we even found water, which as far as life, as far as we know, it needs water. If we found water, that would get tons of people excited. The difficulty comes in being sure that what we're seeing is actually due to life. Because for pretty much every biosignature we see, there is kind of a way to produce it without life. So you look at something like methane, which most of the methane in Earth's atmosphere is produced biologically. Algae and cows and everything on the planet.
Right.
But there are a lot of other ways to produce methane chemically. And right now there's actually people looking at Mars who see spurts of methane coming out, and there's a lot of debate over whether that could be sign of biology beneath the Martian surface, but there's a lot of ways to produce it chemically as well. There's things like oxygen, which on Earth, pretty much all the oxygen is due to life. But if you have the planet with the right conditions, you can actually make good amounts of oxygen without biology. Things like UV light from a star can break water apart, break it into hydrogen and oxygen, and the hydrogen escapes and you're left with a lot of oxygen. There's other signs. So each one on its own, I think, will get people excited but not convinced there's life there. But hopefully one day you'll have a planet and we'll say, oh, there's water, there's oxygen, there's methane, maybe some more complex hydrocarbon signatures. And at that point we'll go, okay, you know, maybe this is all produced by geology in different ways, but once you start to get 4, 5, 6 signatures, then I think we start to say the odds that life is actually there are pretty darn good.
Does water rate a higher priority to discover than oxygen, or are they about equal?
In my opinion, I think oxygen would be more exciting. We know we need water, but if there's oxygen there, I think it's hard to imagine having oxygen without a lot of water. So that's probably a little more on the exciting side.
Our instrumentation, let's just take James Webb, would it be able to detect 4 to 6 biosignatures, or would we be lucky if it could only detect 1 biosignature?
I'd say it has the capability, depending on the size of the planet and how thick its atmosphere is and how strong those signatures are. Certainly, if you have a planet the size of Neptune, which we don't think is habitable because it has a really substantial gas atmosphere.
Right.
But if you had a planet like that had a ton of water in its atmosphere, and we've kind of seen some planets like this already, then that's really easy to see. But a smaller planet like Earth, it probably will be a struggle to get multiple at the start. I think it's going to probably, that probably will take several years if we find a promising candidate to follow up enough to get lots of different signatures. But there's always a possibility that we'll find one that is just it's a small star, so it has a big signal from the planet. It's close. It's bright. We get a lot of light to work with, and we get a lot of good signal. And there could be some that just stand out like a sore thumb, and we go, "Whoa, that one's pretty clear."
So I've got a caller on hold, but let's say someone is on this TOI 700. Is that it?
Yeah, TOI 700.
TOI, okay.
TOI.
So someone's out there for fun, and they're struggling to make equipment and explore, and they're about as technologically advanced as we are.
Hmm.
And all of a sudden, they've got an instrument that detects Earth. Would they be able to detect, I'm flipping the coin here, would they be able to detect multiple biosigns on Earth if they had our kind of equipment and they were on this new exoplanet 40 light years away from Earth? What's your thought?
They would be at a disadvantage compared to us. Because our star is a G star, it's actually, in terms of most of the stars out there, it's a pretty large, hefty star that we orbit. Most of the stars in the universe are like TOI 700 star. They're these small M red dwarf stars. That's like 90% of the stars in our galaxy. And our star is really like in the top 5% of all the stars out there in terms of its size and mass. So when they looked at us, they would go, whoa, that star is big. And if there's an Earth-sized planet there, let's say they know about us, they'll go, oh, that star is big. That planet that's the same size as ours is so tiny compared to that star. It's really hard to tease out any of the light from that planet. It's hard to isolate. Let's maybe move on to some easier other planets nearby, and then we'll get back to that one another decade or two. And I suspect that's what'll happen here. We'll look at the M-dwarf stars like TOI 700. Those are the easiest ones to look at, and we'll work our way up to the bigger stars like the Sun.
Excuse me, you have a caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall in Little Renfro.
Hi, Marshall.
Hey, you were earlier talking about detecting water, and one of the first things that hit me was, okay, Venus is considered the twin planet to Earth, and it has such a high carbon dioxide atmosphere that, I don't think there's any, you know, much water to detect. Earth may be detectable, but let's face it, it's a pretty small percentage. And recent articles I've read basically says there's lots of water underground on Mars, but, there's not much in the atmosphere. So what percentage of water has to be in the atmosphere to count as a water planet?
A great, great, great question. I think in terms of, we are biased. We're living on Earth, which has significant water vapor in the atmosphere, which has large oceans and obviously life. And that's, I think, the type of planet we'll look for. But you're right. Just because we don't detect water vapor in the atmosphere doesn't mean that there couldn't be water underground. Doesn't mean that even if it's frozen, there's enough heat to have water underneath the surface, something like Europa. There could be water in other caverns. So I think that's a great point to keep in mind, that we're looking for things like Earth, but there could be other things unlike Earth that still have life on them. And we're going to have to, I think, remain biased in the meantime, because to detect that life would be even more of a challenge. But I think that's a great point to keep in mind.
Well, it basically points out that we really need all the genius people out there, you know, striving to make that next step in our instruments to make them more sensitive and to, figure out how to filter out and, you know, use the computers to literally detect what's on the planet and its environment. And which gets me into where I was really wanting to go, which is, who's out there doing planetary modeling so that we can come in there and say, yeah, we've got this signal, and this signal. Oh, we better take these instruments and point it at it so we can get a better input.
Absolutely, yeah. There are a whole suite of people that are pioneering the field of, one, astrobiology, and trying to figure out what life signs exist, which ones are detectable. If we saw a signal X, would we be able to back out that's due to life? Is it due to geology? So that's a whole new, brand new field. And then there is another one of, obviously, basically planetary climate modeling. And so there are folks out there that will take newly discovered planets like this TOI 700. And they'll say, all right, based on its orbit and based on the star and maybe the orbit's a little eccentric. You know, if it's tilted this way, it would have this kind of climate. Or basically, here's a bunch of possible scenarios. And they'll run millions of models and say, oh, here's a whole suite of possible scenarios that could exist.
I didn't think about the tilting of the poles. That's a good point right there.
Yeah, I mean, and there's so many unknowns. You know, we get, right now, we're just kind of getting that basic size and distance from the star, but is the atmosphere 1% carbon dioxide, 10%, you know, a very small couple hundred parts per million like ours? What is the mass of water vapor? What is the amount of iron in its core? Is there active plate tectonics or not, and volcanism, and all these possibilities that could exist for these planets, and that has a huge influence on its climate. You could be far away from your host star, have a really thick atmosphere, and be a nice, balmy jungle planet. Or you could be really close to your host star, but have basically no atmosphere and no greenhouse gases and be freezing. So
it sounds like we're going to be well-employed for the next 100 or 200 years.
That, you know, I used to have an advisor who said one of the reasons he picked astronomy to study was because he thought it was a laboratory where there was just no end of experiments, and I think that's true.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Marshall. Listeners, that's Marshall getting off the phone line, and our line is available if you would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223. Those of you that said earlier that there was an audio problem, can you send me an email and give me a sound check so I want to follow up and make sure you're hearing our guest and myself and Marshall as well, okay? I would appreciate that. Also, we're sort of halfway in the program because of the problem I had in needing to restart the show. So I do want to just mention real briefly our sponsors again, because we wouldn't be doing the show without the sponsors, and we do have some sponsorships available for 2020. Do remember that Northrop Grumman sponsors us, and they're a leading global security company. They have capabilities that extend from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. Of course, they're global. The Space Foundation is coming up with their new meeting, March 30th to April 2nd in Colorado Springs. You can check them out, do one-stop shopping for all your reservations and everything at spacesymposium.org. And Astrox sponsors us, and they've been doing hypersonic work with the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for 3 decades. They have high side and space side, and they do other kinds of analysis and creating different techniques for their designs. You can get a lot more information, and for those of you interested in hypersonics, go to astrox.com. AIAA sponsors us, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And all of their people who are members work in the industry for the most part, and they help create the industry on a day-by-day basis, advancing aerospace engineering. And you can attend. You don't have to be a member to join. They have 5 major events and then regional breakfast meetings, lunch meetings, dinner meetings, great networking, and an incredible peer-reviewed library. Moonward sponsors us. Then what if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon and base their decisions only on technical and economic merit? Moonwards is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwards.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. Remember that Celestis sponsors us, and they've got a big mission catalog or a mission agenda coming up from the Cape, from New Mexico with suborbital, and returning to the moon. So you definitely want to check all of that out. If you have a loved one who you would like to send to space with some of his or her ashes, or maybe include your own DNA with the person, you can do that. Contact Celestis, CELESTIS.com. And then the Integrated Space Plan sponsors us, the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. So check it all out at thespaceplan.com, and you can buy your own copy as well. Jeff, what do you think of these ideas to do interstellar flights and send wafers or some kind of light mission or something to an exoplanet? Do you see it happening? Do you want it to happen? Do you think it's plausible? What are your thoughts on these kind of forward-thinking missions?
Yeah, I think it's fantastic to start pursuing now. It may be a little science fiction-y as we sit here, but science fiction becomes science fact before, you know, quicker than we're used to. So I think it's great to look at. Some of the ones where there's been ideas to use some Earth-based lasers to accelerate little tiny spacecraft with cameras on them to 20% the speed of light to be able to get some return images in a human lifetime, those are exciting to me. And one of the reasons is, you know, we're talking about all the things we can do from Earth and the amazing technological progress we're making and finding these other planets similar to Earth and probing and finding out what they're made of. But there's kind of a fundamental limit there. We're never really going to get from Earth without some massive space engineering project a picture of that planet where we can see a continent, where we can see continents and, you know, really get a clear picture or be able to do things like know for sure I've imaged life on that planet. So ultimately, one day or year or century, what we have to do is send probes to some of the most promising places that we found and then really know for sure. And it'll take a long time and probably be a multi-generation effort, but I think it's one it's good to start pursuing now.
When you say take a lot of time, what do you think that kind of time frame is going to be?
So some of the, I think, most ambitious proposals I've seen are an example, a mission to, say, Alpha Centauri, our closest neighbor.
Right.
Which is about 4 light years away. And so if you can get up to, let's be optimistic and say 20% the speed of light, so you get some really nano, super lightweight spacecraft or a swarm of them, and you use a laser to accelerate them up to that 20% the speed of light, that means it's still going to take about 20 years to get to that, to get to Alpha Centauri 4 light years away. And so 20 years there, another 4 years for any signals they send to get back to Earth, you know, you're looking at about a 25-year mission. And that's in a really optimistic case.
How do you think the technology might be different in 25 years? What will we be doing with exoplanets then that we're not able to do today? Any ideas? Want to jump ahead and guess?
Sure. And just to be clear, that's if we can launch them, we're waiting 25 years to get the answer back.
Right.
I think we're quite a long, many, many decades away from even being able to launch something like that. But in terms of the next couple decades of exoplanets, I think it's real exciting. So over the next couple decades, we'll start with things like James Webb, where we start to be able to sniff out the atmospheres of these planets. And then starting in hopefully the 2030s or by 2040s, we'll have the next generation of telescopes, which they're still in the design phases, the early design phases. But the goal seems to be to build telescopes that are capable of doing that direct imaging and directly imaging other Earth-sized planets around nearby stars. So when those start returning results in, the late 2030s or 2040s, hopefully we'll actually have direct images of these Earth-like planets and maybe know of a couple dozen that are relatively nearby in astronomy terms that we can start following up and finding out what their atmosphere is made of and then really start to plan out some of these crazy generational missions.
Ben is in Tucson with an email. Can good amateur equipment detect exoplanets?
You know, fantastic question, because I wanted to mention this, that yes, absolutely. So nowadays, it's a digital camera, a CCD camera for a telescope off the shelf is affordable and can make some really high precision measurements. And so there have been numerous cases of amateurs who take even their, say, 12-inch telescope in their backyard, slap the digital camera on it, and you can measure a drop of light of at least 1%, and there are some big exoplanets out there that were discovered back in the 90s And now amateurs can follow up and say, oh, yep, I see that planet. I see the dip in light. And I think there's been some novel discoveries, too, where amateurs are just able to take a lot of observations and find some of these bigger planets. You won't be finding Earth-sized planets, but some of the big ones for sure.
Pretty amazing.
It's so cool what a person can do these days there. And then on top of that, we have all this great data from Kepler and K2, now from the new TESS mission. There's other things coming online. And so there's actually been discoveries by so many, you know, I'll just say amateur astronomers out there. There was a car mechanic in Australia who found a three-planet system using K2 data that came out a couple years ago. Just was helping just flip through. There's so much data to look at. Just looking by eye, saw something that looked interesting and turned out. In the news the other week, there was a high school planet who did an internship with the NASA Goddard Space Center, which runs the test mission.
Right.
And I think on this student's third day of looking at data as a high school intern, found a planet, and it was actually a unique one. It was what's called a circumbinary planet. So it was one planet orbiting two stars. And it was the first such planet to be found in test data. So again, a high school student on the third day found that. So there's all sorts of discoveries to be made. There's more data than the professionals have time to look at.
Fascinating. It really seems like a fast moving world, doesn't it?
It's incredible. And I'll plug a website called the main one is called Zooniverse.org, but there's a project in there called Planet Hunters. So if you Google Planet Hunters, you should be able to see that. And it's a group of amateurs and people who just want to help find planets that have some time to look through data. So that's something great that everyone can check out and get involved.
We can access those websites without any problem then, right? They're available.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, Planet Hunters is designed for everybody. It's designed to get the public involved in finding exoplanets.
Carrie is in Austin, Texas, and listeners, we can still take phone calls, so we'd love to hear from you. 866-687-7223. Carrie says, do you spend any time, do you do any research with these fast-moving interstellar objects that have been reported of late, and what can you tell us about those?
Sure. So I personally don't, but I have some colleagues at the SETI Institute who do and have talked about them. So I will do my best without overstepping my bounds. But that is another neat consequence of this new day and age where we're just getting a fire hose of data and we're able to image huge swaths of the sky every night, is that we're finding these interstellar asteroids, basically. And this kind of ties into some of the discoveries we're finding in exoplanets, that we kind of now know that when planet systems formed, we used to think they were kind of nice, orderly, you know, well-behaved affairs where planets slowly coalesced and formed and everyone was happy and kumbaya. Now we're finding that solar system formation is actually kind of violent. You have planets form near each other. Some planets get ejected from the system. Material gets mixed up. And so when things form, a lot of material gets ejected, and a lot of those are these asteroid-sized objects. And so some of the ones we've seen come through our solar system recently are fascinating because we know they didn't form here. They're on an orbit, so they're not bound to our star. They're just grazing and passing through. But I think the remarkable thing is their composition is kind of similar. It's distinct but similar to our solar system in its asteroid composition. So we're finding that, yeah, every solar system is probably unique, and it's formed in its all unique way, but we're all made of the same chemical elements. We all went through somewhat similar processes, and I think it's further confirmation that we're unique, but we're not alone, and we're not that unique.
So you don't think we're alone in the universe?
In terms of having similar chemical composition, and there's you know, pretty much most definitely planets out there with water on them, similar chemicals, similar, you know, the same physics at play, at least in those terms, the solar system's not alone.
But what about in terms of life? Do you think we'll eventually find life out there?
I sure hope so. And if I had to place a bet whether we would or not in my lifetime, I think we'll have some darn good evidence that at least single single cell biological life is out there beyond Earth. But it's tough. As a scientist, I can't say for sure we will. I can't say for sure we won't. But, you know, again, we keep looking out there and we find that there's lots of other stars like the sun and stars not like the sun. There's seems to be planets around nearly all these stars. Again, the same chemistry seems to take place. The same laws of physics are at play. So just given billions of stars and probably trillions of planets, the odds that life isn't out there somewhere, I think, are tiny. I don't think we found any evidence yet, but we hope we do one day. I would be shocked if we're truly the only life in the universe.
Linda's in Atlanta with another email and says, years ago, when exoplanets were newer and more of a hot talking item, perhaps than they are today, David did a program with someone who was spending his time searching for exoplanet moons. Has one ever been found?
Oh, great question. There is, to my knowledge, one good candidate right now of an exomoon, and it's still, I think, a little bit controversial as to whether it exists or not. It was found in Kepler data, and the way they looked for it is that you look at known transiting planets. So in this case, it was a planet that I think went around roughly about once a year or so. So we had maybe four or so transits of this planet, maybe a few more than that. And what they looked for is, in addition to the normal dip in light you would expect to see, if it has a moon around it, you would sometimes expect to see a little dip happen right before the main planet dipped. If the moon's leading, or depending on the orbit, there could be a little dip afterwards. There could be no dip if the moon was right behind or in front of that planet. So they basically just threw millions and millions of possible combinations of how a potential moon could be orbiting this planet and see if any fit. And in this one case, they said, ooh, there's good evidence there's a moon there, but it's not quite good enough to confirm it. And so I know people have been trying to follow that up and see if it's really there or not. But it's a challenge because in this case, if that moon existed, it would be a planet several times the mass of Jupiter with a moon about the size of Neptune, which is nothing like that exists in our solar system. So to find a moon that's the size of Earth would be a real technical challenge at the moment. But I would be shocked if we don't find one that everyone agrees, oh, yeah, that's definitely there sometime soon.
Well, if there's all these planets that you talked about, trillions of planets, there's got to be moons out there.
Oh, yeah. And now right now, if we knew a planet just like Jupiter, which we now know has, I think, gosh, close to like 80 moons at this point, if we were looking at a Jupiter planet with those same set of moons that we all know, Europa and Ganymede and Io and the others, we would not be able to detect those with our current technology. They're just too small. But hopefully the next generation of telescopes might be able to tease something like that out.
So none of Jupiter's moons could we detect right now?
Right. They're just too small compared to the size of Jupiter, too small on their own to really show up in a significant way.
Finding a moon on an exoplanet, what does that tell us? Does it tell us something about the exoplanet, or what makes it so interesting?
Yeah, I think there's two sides to that. The first one is the possibility of a moon being habitable. So maybe you have a Jupiter-sized planet that's at the same distance from a star like the sun as Earth is, and then around that Jupiter-sized planet, which isn't habitable itself, but the moon is Earth-sized, and maybe that moon has an atmosphere like Earth and water and oceans, and that's basically the plot of Avatar, the science fiction planet Pandora,
right.
is a moon around a Jupiter-like world in Alpha Centauri. And so that's an exciting prospect in itself because you might see the Jupiter-sized planet first and go, oh, darn, Jupiter-sized planet, not habitable. But you stare some more and you go, oh, there's an Earth-sized moon. That could be habitable. So that's one of the exciting sides. The other one I think is kind of as far as I'm aware, kind of big unresolved question, which is, hey, we're Earth. We have our moon right next door that we all know and love. And there's, I think, a lot of debate over whether having that moon so close by has helped foster the development of life on Earth. If causing tides has helped, for example, life being able to rise out of the oceans and onto land, if it's helped stabilize their inclination so we've had a more stable long-term climate, and other ways like that. So I think the jury's still out there. I've heard arguments where, oh, it really helps to have a moon. I've heard arguments where it says, moon or no moon, life can be fine. I'm not sure. But certainly I think it doesn't hurt to have a moon. So if we find a planet like Earth and we got some good biosignatures and we happen to see that it has a moon, that's maybe even further evidence that it's a habitable place.
Here's an interesting listener question. Listeners, we can still do phone calls. You don't have to be emailing. 1-866-687-7223. So Ken is in Las Vegas, Nevada, and he says, what, in your opinion, would be the best technological advancement for advancing exoplanet study that we could dream of? What would be a dream instrument or a dream capability?
Ah, great question. I'm going to give two.
Okay.
The first one is, remember how I mentioned the different detection methods, and the first one I mentioned was astrometry,
right?
Which had a lot of false detections early on and hasn't quite panned out. There are some great concepts for being able to build a array of telescopes in space that could do astrometry to basically a millionth of a degree. And in that case, you could measure all these stars' positions simultaneously and actually be able to detect signals at a level where you could find Earth-sized planets. So that is one, to me, where if we could get that technology polished off in space, that's a promising way to detect a lot of Earth-sized planets at once, and especially around the closest stars to us.
Are we working on that technology?
We are. There was a mission concept which didn't end up getting built, but it was called SIM, the Space Interferometry Mission. And then later on, it was kind of an attempt to save it. I think it was downsized a little bit, and then called SIM Light. And that one, that was the concept of being able to do that astrometry at a high precision. I forget the exact reasons it didn't end up getting built. There's a lot of times that NASA will do a mission study on a potential way, and then there's so many ideas to choose from. Not everything can get chosen. But that's one that I personally would like to see dusted off one day and maybe polished and upgraded and see if it got flown.
What's the second one that you'd want to see?
The second one is doing the direct imaging of Earth-sized planets. So that is starting to be talked about in the community, and the initial designs worked on for launches in the mid to late 2030s. And so there's a couple designs and ideas floating around out there. And the technology seems, to me, seems feasible, especially by the 2030s. And in that case, if we can get these off the ground, and they would be, Hubble, James Webb class, these really large missions. But if we get those off the ground and we're actually directly imaging other planets similar to Earth, around stars similar to the Sun, that are close by to us, and being able to stare at each star and say, all right, I'm going to stare. I'm going to be able to within a couple days, find out if there are any planets in the solar system. Oh, they're not. Okay, let me move to the next one. Oh, I found five of them. Okay, great. Let me move to the next one. And we start to be able to do a census of all the nearby stars to us and actually know down to the size of Earth every single planet that's around all these nearby stars. That, to me, is crazy exciting.
You have a phone call, so.
All right.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Oh, this is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. I have a list of interesting question here. I want to run by you and see. My perception is that if you have a planet, like an Earth-like planet, that has a high oxygen content, sort of like Earth does, is that a clear signature that the planet has an active biosphere, or could that happen on a completely, let's say, dead planet?
Great question, John. On Earth, nearly all the oxygen we have is produced from biology. So if we were to see that on another planet, I think our first conclusion would be, oh, that is pretty likely due to biology. But there are ways to produce it abiologically, so again, without biology. And one of those mechanisms is if you have a lot of water vapor on that planet, and so a lot of H2O floating around in the atmosphere, and you have a star which has a lot of ultraviolet light. Some of that ultraviolet light can hit the water vapor, and it breaks it up into hydrogen and oxygen. And hydrogen is light, and so it can boil away and run off into space while the oxygen stays behind. So it is possible over millions or billions of years to have a planet that has no life at all, but has a lot of water, slowly have it dissociate into hydrogen and oxygen, but only the oxygen gets left behind. So that's one mechanism that you could produce a lot of oxygen without biology. That's not what happened on Earth. We don't see that happen in the solar system. We have some models that say that could happen. So I think what would happen is if we found a planet with a lot of oxygen, the people who are really good at modeling would then look at all the details and see if it's possible to be from that mechanism or something else geologically. And we'd slowly either be able to say, yeah, you know, there's a decent chance this isn't due to biology, or maybe say, you know, given that star, given the distance, given everything we know, that there's no mechanism that pans out. We've ruled them all out, and the very most likely thing is biology. And so I'm sure it would take years of debate and people going back and forth, but I think at the end of the day, we'd hopefully settle on one or the other.
Yeah. Well, would that indicate this other mechanism you were discussing with ultraviolet light, would that indicate a certain type of star then that might be different than the sun or something would create a situation like that?
Yeah, but my understanding, you need a planet that's putting off a lot of ultraviolet light. And that could come from a star that's a little bigger and hotter than the sun, or it could be from a star that's just very active and has a lot of solar flares and a lot of activity happening with it.
Wouldn't they have a high cancer rate, those people on that planet?
They might. I mean, maybe they evolved a way to work.
Now, I have a question for you with John on the phone, because you work for SETI, right?
Right.
I did think you were at NASA Ames, but I always get that confused.
A little of both.
But you're over at SETI.
Right.
To detect the possibility of life out there, are we better off putting resources into exoplanets or the SETI method of listening for signals with more and powerful radio telescopes, maybe even putting them on the far side of the moon?
So with the SETI Institute that I work for, what they've done is said, hey, let's do it all. One reason I work for them on the exoplanet side is because if we can figure out how common planets similar to Earth are out there and how common these biosignatures may be, that tells us directly about how common life may be in the universe. But absolutely, they're also doing the direct radio listening method of trying to listen to see if we pick up any signals from a civilization like us or more advanced. And it's hard to say where to put resources. Certainly the radio side is probably more of a long shot. There's a clearer vision on the exoplanet side of how we're going to progress over the next several decades and how technology develops, and we know what's possible, and we'll slowly work our way to more Earth-like planets and better biosignature detections. The radio side, we could listen and get more and more and more sensitive and not find anything, so the payoff may be all or nothing. But I think the radio side is great, too, because if we do find a signal that's unmistakably due to another civilization, that's a game-changing discovery of the century. And even if we don't, if we are able to get such sensitive telescopes that we can search out to thousands of light years and say there's definitely no signal from a civilization like ours or more advanced, that also tells us something unique. And that tells us just how uncommon advanced intelligent life may be in the universe. And I think it's valuable to know both.
Does putting radio telescopes or exoplanet stuff on the far side of the moon make a big difference?
You know, that's a little outside my expertise on exactly how big a gain we get from putting them on the far side of the moon. I know it definitely is much more radio quiet because you're able to block out the whole Earth and all interference. But at the same time, the way the radio frequency on Earth, radio spectrum on Earth is managed, there are zones that are reserved exclusively for astronomy use. So civilians and military don't broadcast at certain frequencies, and those stay clean for astronomers to listen to. And I know it's always a contention on, you know, how much bandwidth is reserved for people to broadcast and how much to listen. But
I think they struck some good deals. So that the really important parts of the radio spectrum where we think if there are other civilizations out there, what frequency they might use to communicate, those are reserved, and I think fairly clean on Earth.
John, do you have more?
Since you're getting into that sort of an issue, I was wondering, I mean, we're putting out a lot of signal right now from one point of view, but to what degree would a hypothetical SETI from another civilization be able to detect us, and how far away would that be? That would be interesting.
Yeah, I think, and I'm going to put a disclaimer that I'm not sure on the hard numbers, but I think we could not detect our own civilization very far out. Maybe something like a couple to 10 or maybe 20 light years is what I have in my head, that it's not real far out. That right now, if we detect anything, very likely it would be a civilization capable of broadcasting much stronger signals than we are. But certainly if there are more advanced civilizations out there that have big radio dishes, that are more sensitive and more advanced than ours, we've been sending radio waves out into space since at least the 30s. All the high-powered military radar around the world sends out some very powerful signals and have been for a long time. So we've been broadcasting our presence, whether intentionally or not, for quite a long time now. And so if there is a really advanced civilization out there, they would probably be able to detect us if they had big enough radio dishes.
While John is on the phone, Barbara is in San Francisco, and she says, given that you are a PhD in astronomy, are you at all concerned about LEO, small sat to medium sat constellations for satellites that are going up in terms of ruining the night sky for your astronomy work?
I've seen some interesting discussion on this lately. So these low Earth orbit satellites, things like
SpaceX
Starlink,
and
SpaceX.
Right, yeah. And,
yeah, and
OneWeb and
lots of ones out there. As the commercial side is able to do launches cheaper and faster, there's definitely going to be a lot more satellites up there. I haven't seen myself a hard analysis of exactly how much it'll impact astronomy. Certainly, a bright spot whizzing through your image isn't fun to deal with. But we're also now getting so many thousands of images every night that, at least I think on the professional side, we can throw out a few if a satellite happens to pass during that exposure. So I'll say personally, I'm not that concerned. I think we can overcome it in the field. But I'm also not an expert on exactly how that'll impact a lot of these large surveys. So hopefully at the end of the day, a nice compromise can be struck where everyone is able to get that cheap broadband worldwide internet, and at the same time, maybe their orbits can be tweaked or put on some anti-reflective coating so that astronomy happens at the same time.
John, anything else from you, or I'll let you go. Maybe someone else wants to call before we wind up the program.
Well, one kind of last thing I was going to mention, that from what you're telling me about the ability to detect a civilization like ours, wouldn't that be the case that if we could detect somebody, it's somebody out there that's kind of saying, hey, look at us, that they're deliberately sending out a signal to be noticed and identified, unless they're very close, let's say.
Right. I would agree with that. Most likely, if we detect anything, it's probably intentional. No, maybe not. Maybe they have some super ultra mega powerful military radar that they're using, and they're unintentionally sending these really powerful signals that we're able to pick up. Maybe that's the case. But yeah, I think most likely if we detect something, say tomorrow, most likely it probably would be an intentional signal, just again due to the vast distances and how fast these radio signals drop off, that in that case either they're broadcasting a really powerful signal everywhere, or they know we're here and they're sending a specific signal. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll get off for now and see if anybody else wants to go on.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
Listeners, there's a few more minutes left. If you would like to give us a call, it is 1-866-687-7223. What's What do you think we're going to see in 2020 unfold? Anything really big with exoplanets?
Oh, let's see. I think we're going to see more and more exoplanets keep coming from the... we're still finding planets, amazing or not, in the original Kepler data and in the K2 data set, which have been out for several years. So that's fantastic to see. And I think we're going to see even more come from the test mission, which is continuing to collect data and entering its third year of observations. So that I think will continue to be a fire hose of exoplanets, and hopefully some of the smaller, more Earth-sized, challenging ones to find will also pop out. And then I think we'll just see continued technology progress and milestones on just keep pushing the envelope to smaller, cooler planets and kind of all the methods and radio velocity and transit and some of the direct imaging. The advancements are exciting. So it's just neat to see it all happen one year at a time.
Any big breakthroughs anticipated?
I personally wouldn't say any big breakthroughs, but the pace is rapid enough where, I guess, in the heat of the moment, it all seems like gradual progress. But when you look back, you go, oh, wow, those last 5 years together were quite a leap. Oh, and the 5 years before that were a leap, too. I mean, we look back 10 years, and we didn't. So 10 years is 2010. Kepler had just launched. We knew of some big Jupiter-sized planets. We didn't really know of stars with a lot of multiple planet systems. We didn't know of planets the size of Earth. Looking back, we're pretty ignorant. So in the past 10 years that now we know of multiple planets the size of Earth that are likely in their habitable zone, and we have signatures of water vapor and methane on other planets, even if they're big ones, that has been tremendous progress over the past 10 years.
I have an email from George. This may be our last one, and I guess we're going to go out with sort of a weird bang. I've never had this question asked before.
I like it.
So I don't know if you're going to like it or not. So George is in Memphis, and he says, you guys are probably going to think I'm nuts, but if there is life out there, and maybe they're more advanced than we are, maybe, like us, they send orbiting satellites around different planets to check them out, like we do, to check out things in our own solar system. Is there any way we would detect for sure if there was an orbiting satellite around Earth or Mars or Jupiter or something in our solar system that we didn't put there? Could something be so sophisticated and so highly tech designed that it would escape us, but it could be orbiting and studying us for another civilization like we do when we go to Mars or Jupiter or Saturn?
You know, I don't think that's too nuts a question at all. That's actually really really smart to think about. I'd say it's possible. So going back a bit to the question about the interstellar asteroid or two that have been found recently, there was a lot of speculation of, and I call it just kind of rampant speculation of, oh, what if that's an interstellar probe? And there was really nothing scientifically to indicate that at all for those, except that it came from outside the solar system.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, generally, it did generate a lot of what-ifs, you know, something like that came in. And so I think what it would have to do for us to be able to say, oh, yeah, that's definitely a probe from another civilization, is to have some sort of radio transmitter on it where it comes into the solar system and it's transmitting, you know, radio similar to our probes send out that we pick up and we go, oh, what's that signal? We didn't launch anything over there. Oh, okay. Oh, and it's, you know, maybe it's broadcasting prime numbers or it's doing something else. I think that's what would be needed for us to see it. But if it was, if they sent a probe that was, you know, similar to the stuff that we send out in the solar system to Mars and Venus and Jupiter and Saturn, and it was broadcasting a similar strength that our own probes broadcast, we probably would be able to pick it up and hone in on it. And I guess from there we would either listen if there's a message or maybe try and send something out to go and investigate it. But I don't think it's crazy because I'm going to guess, just again, let's go rampant speculation, go out 100, 200 years. I think that's what humanity will end up doing, and that getting humans to other stars and other exoplanets is to say it's a challenge is an understatement. you know, the time scales are so long, the distances are so long, the technology, having humans live in space is such a challenge that the first step probably will be to build these fast-moving interstellar probes to send to nearby planets around other stars. And so if we assume another civilization like us is having the same train of thought and they're also biological and squishy and tough to go other places, sending probes for them would be the first step too. So I don't think it's a crazy idea that one day that might happen, but I think we'd have to be darn lucky to be alive at just the right time in the short time span humanity's has had to pick up another probe at just the right time. But I never know.
I wonder what we'd do with it. I wonder if we want to interfere with it, if we want to track it and trace it, if we'd want to try to see where it came from. It'd be interesting what our reaction would be. I mean, I'll be long gone. You probably will be too. But what a future Earth population might do if they realize that they're being studied by someplace else.
The only thing I know for sure in that situation is there'd be no shortage of opinions on what to do.
Absolutely. That'd be really cool to be able to have some choices to make about something like that.
Yes, indeed.
Have we missed anything? Should we have talked about something that we have overlooked or didn't have enough wisdom to know to even ask you?
My gosh, there's so many topics. I'll skip this one. I'll leave with one last one I wrote down, which actually isn't related to exoplanets, but I thought it was a really neat discovery. Which is that we found astronomers in general found this binary star that, you know, mark your calendars, in the year 2083, plus or minus about a decade, we now know that that thing will go nova and brighten up to be probably brighter than Sirius, maybe as bright as Venus in the nighttime sky. So for some of the younger listeners out there, we know of at least one possibly nova-like event that we really haven't seen anything like it. Since I think at the 1600s one of the other old supernovas that went off. So it's kind of neat that we're able to see some events and predict them many, many decades out and can set our calendars. And if some of us are still around by then, there'll be once in a lifetime events to look forward to.
So let's say the earliest might be 2070 if we push it.
Yeah.
So
maybe 2065 if you're optimistic.
Well, so 45 years. So I'd be, well over 110, so if I'm around, I probably wouldn't care. that would be cool to see. So
yeah, I thought that was a neat headline.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I appreciate your coming back and being with the Full Space Show program, and I hope we can call on you and check in with you later on, as I'm sure our exoplanet interest and questions will continue to rise. And I'm sure you'll hear from us again, and we really appreciate your being with us tonight.
Fantastic. Would love to. There's no shortage of discoveries these days to talk about.
Absolutely. So you're actually at SETI in Menlo Park?
Right. Yeah, so I work directly for the SETI Institute and do work for the Kepler mission.
Is there anything to see on a tour?
A lot of cubicles, monitors, desks. It's the location on site is pretty boring.
Okay, so because Sonoma's not that far away, but cubicles I don't need to tour and see. Jeff, thank you very much for being with us, and I'm sure we'll be back with you both for Hotel Mars and the Space Show later in the year and when we read about new and exciting exoplanet discoveries. So you'll hear from us again, and once again, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, David.
And listeners, that's it. So remember, we're not having a show on Friday. Hotel Mars is tomorrow with Bob Zubrin, so you'll want to hear that when Mr. Batchelor archives it. And then back again on Sunday on the Big Rocket Book with Mark Canepa. Everybody have a great rest of the week and stay safe. And thanks to Jeff and all of you who called and emailed. Have a, as I said, a good, safe rest of the week. And above all, keep looking up. Good night from the Space Show.